Herzlich willkommen bei Klinisch Relevant, deinem Wissenspartner für das Gesundheitswesen. Dreimal pro Woche, nämlich dienstags, donnerstags und samstags, versorgen wir dich mit unserem Podcast und bringen dir Fachwissen in deine klinische Praxis. Weitere Informationen und Angebote findest du auf unserer Webseite www.klinisch-relevant.de. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören!
Hello and welcome to another episode of Klinisch Relevant. I'm very excited to have Deacon Joseph Ferrari back with me for a part two. If you haven't heard our part one, back in February, we talked about procrastination. It was a really enthralling conversation. We talked about procrastination, how it differs from delaying, postponing, how it relates to perfectionism, failure and success, and the difference between procrastinating and prioritizing. And we finished that episode on quite a cliffhanger because we wanted to gear up for a part two, which is now. And we're going to talk about decisional procrastination and indecisiveness. So thank you so much for joining me again. I'm very excited for our talk today.
It's great to be here with you again, Dr. Reynolds. I want listeners to understand that another name for decisional procrastination is indecision, indecisiveness. It's when we think of procrastination, most people think of the behavioral aspect, the tasks that people don't do. And that's what we call behavioral. But there's a cognitive form, and that's indecision. They are related, but they're separate. They correlate. Obviously, if someone's being indecisive, they're not acting. If someone's not acting, though, they may not be because they're indecisive. So, you know, there's a correlation between them, but not identical. There has not been lots of research on this particular topic until I started doing some work in the 90s. And even now, not as much. But before I go down that path, do you have a particular question or comment or some way you'd like me to begin? You know me, I just jump right in.
In our last episode, you kind of, teased that decisional procrastinators, they are able to make decisions. And I know in your book, you mentioned that they weren't able, yes, sorry, the book is called Still Procrastinating, The No Regrets Guide to Getting It Done. I can recommend. That decisional procrastinators weren't able to maintain speed and accuracy in decision-making. And they also gather information differently than non-procrastinators. And I guess I just find this so interesting, again, because of my field as a doctor. This is one of our, what we get paid to do is to make decisions. And I'm wondering if you are a decisional procrastinator, does this affect how you make decisions in the clinical field? Maybe, could this inform education? Maybe simulation training with practice? Can someone learn to be a better decision maker? I suppose that's where I was coming from. I want to hear your thoughts, what you have to tell us about decisional procrastination.
Sure. Thank you. This goes back to the late 90s, 95, 96, 97, 98. I worked with a colleague. Let me give you the story, since people are listening and they may be driving or something, so to kill some time here. I was at a small college, which has now closed. It was so small and went bankrupt, in central New York, called Cazenovia College. I was half the psych faculty. The other half had no doctorate. She was an excellent teacher for the psych of women and human sexuality and taught some of the earlier courses. But there was no scholarship going on in that that school. And I knew I didn't want to stay there. It was supposed to be a temporary scenario. Down the road from me, from where I was living, there was a Colgate University in Hamilton, New York. And there was a very famous colleague there, Jack DeVidio. So I made an appointment to talk to Jack, and I said, look, I'm at this place. They don't do research. You're at a place. You've got great undergraduates. It's an undergraduate institution. And if you don't mind working with me, I'll collect the data. If you can analyze, I don't have, there was only two computers on campus in the 90s, and I had one of them. You know, I don't have the software to do the data analysis statistically, if you don't mind doing that. And he said, sure. So you'll see that there's a number of studies, a few studies by Ferrari and DeVidio. And that's the background between of that. And he was a great mentor. I mean, I would collect the data, and every 4, 5, 6 months, I'd travel down. We'd discuss it. I'd go write it up. And it was great. It was a great partnership. Dr. DeVidio, John DeVidio, Jack, as you know, moved on to, I believe, UConn, University of Connecticut, then to Yale, and he's now retired. So what did we do? So the very first set of studies we did was to address what you mentioned a moment ago about the ability to make decisions. I was wondering, are people who are indecisive, is it a cognitive failure or a motivational choice or a cognitive failure? Sorry, this is drifting. What I was wondering was, is it for someone who's indecisive, an inability, cognitive failure, to make the choices, or are they choosing not to make it? That was important to understand. So in a series of reaction time studies, and perhaps, listener, you know what I'm talking about, studies that look at how fast can you respond. We had simple reaction time tasks that I ran people in, and more complex reaction time tasks, and basically found no significant difference between people who identified as procrastinators and those who did not. So, often in science, we don't publish studies with the null hypothesis being supported where there's no significant difference. But I did, because this was kind of pioneering in a way of saying, look, people who are indecisive, it isn't because they have cognitive failures, inability to do this. They can make it. They can in all these tasks, we had about 4 to 6 tasks that they're choosing. So if it's not a cognitive failure, it must be a choice. You know, it's the alternative. And so those were our early studies that we published. Then we moved into, let's do some experimental studies and manipulate the ability for indecisive to search information. But before I do let me go back that one listener, if you're listening, that you may be thinking there's a body of literature, and it's a small, on career indecision, people who can't decide. What got me into the topic of procrastination was when I was in grad school in the late 80s, the topic of procrastination came up as a self-handicapping strategy. And at that time, you know, I remember raising it in a class and the professor saying, someone must have studied this already. Nobody had studied this. So when I went to the library, what I did find, we didn't have the internet then. So we went to the library to look at the old stacks. I still miss that, pulling out the journals. Took more time, but it was tangible. You felt the journals and stuff. There was a whole body of literature, not too large, but a body on career indecision, decisional. Indecision, but for careers. So I always remembered that. When it came time to do my dissertation and my lines of research, I wanted a behavioral measures of self-report measures on procrastinating. Are you a procrastinator or not? But there was also a great measure by a guy by the name of Leon Mann, was at Flinders University in Australia, in Sydney. No, Melbourne. He developed a 5-item questionnaire that looked at indecision. So I guess what I'm saying is most of my experimental studies, most of my studies would include the 5-item indecision scale so I could look at it cognitively, and then a 15-item by Johnson and McCowan that looked at behavioral procrastination. Because I think you got to look at it both ways is what I'm trying to say, to show that this is not a task delay. There's something more. Listeners here may be familiar with, or if you're old enough to remember, there was a model for Janice and Mann, and they were looking at the two of them. I believe at that time they were at, this is when I was like in college, it was a long time ago, so I'm trying to remember, the University of Illinois. They were apparently very good friends, but then they had as typical happens, a parting of the ways. And so when Leon Mann left that, and there was a lot of in their research on groupthink, That's right. Group dynamics. That was their thing. Janice and Mann. They, he went to Australia. I don't know, in between. Very nice man. When I had a sabbatical at the University of Tasmania, which was awesome, back in 2002, he invited me to come to the mainland and to Melbourne and give a talk. And that's when I met him. Because I was doing research on procrastination using his measure. In Flinders University, he developed a self-report measure that looks at decisional confidence. How confident am I? And then decisional procrastination. It was a 5-item subscale within this other scale. So that's what I always use. So I like to look at the individual differences of indecisives and people who are indecisive and decisive. There is a whole body of research in psychology called judgment and decision making, where people focus on all of that. And I remember going to Michigan here when I was at DePaul, fast forward many years, being invited to talk on my work on indecision. And I was the only one of all the presenters who looked at the individual differences. People who are indecisive compared to those that are not. Everyone else in that field, now maybe the field has changed, but back then it was much more, you looked at reaction time to decide whether someone's indecisive or not. I was doing the self-report measure. So again, not a large body of literature. I don't think people have really jumped on the literature since this, unfortunately, because it really is kind of cool, which takes me into the information searching. So I've talked a little bit about how I got into this, how the field in judgment and decision-making, what do they call that, JDM, I think, is a very interesting growing area of research in psychology, experimental psych. It's not my particular area, so I can't really talk to you too much about that. But listener, you may want to explore that if this is something that really fascinates you. So judgment and decision-making research, but again, they weren't looking at the individual differences, people who are or are not. They're sort of responding, and nothing wrong with it, it's just another approach, looking at people who take longer. And then I talk a little bit about one of my early questions was that of, is it a cognitive failure or is it a motivational choice? And again, my handful of studies back then kind of showed it was a motivational choice. Listener, there's so much more you can do on all of this. I invite you to do that. You want me to be a co-author? I'll read your paper at the end. I love that. But now, so having done this with Jack DeVideo, looking at these studies, the next round of studies, we looked at how do indecisives compared to decisives search information. This was kind of interesting. There was a paradigm, a procedure that was created by a guy named John Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, I think it was in consumer psych. You're asking me to go back 25, 30 years, more than 30 years. So by John Payne, and what he did was develop, and this is the old days, and it's too bad we don't have a graphic. I'm trying to think of how I can explain this. This is before computers. You can do this on computers now. But what I did was take a half a sheet of plywood, right? And then attach half envelopes. Took legal size envelopes. You cut them in half.
Oops. Yeah.
And, take the envelope, cut it in half, attach it to the plywood, and have a series of envelopes. Then inside in each envelope, I would attach, and I would actually do it this way so you wouldn't have that in the way, attach that. I would have an index card with some information on it.
So just if I can paraphrase that, it's sort of like you had a piece of wood with pockets hanging onto it, and then in these pockets were index cards.
Index cards face down with information. So I imagine it like this. So you would say to the participant, you have a choice. Here's A, B, C, D. You could vary the number of items you wanted them to search on. So sometimes we gave them 2. Sometimes we might give them 5. And then we had all these pockets, and you could vary whether each column of the pockets was some variable. Price of the item. Because he did this in consumers. Availability of the item. And you could vary the number of columns, if you would. Right? I only drew 4 here, but you could have up to 6. You can have as many as you want. You with me? So the person would sit in that. So I could vary the amount of information that they would search. And I would tell. And then I would have on a sheet of paper, again, this is the old days, off to the side behind the person, this schematic. And as they would pull a card out, I could write down which order they did. You know, did they do 1, 2, 3, 4? So you can look at, did they go interdimensional between dimensions? And did they search intra-dimensional within? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Very cool. It can be done on computers now, but this was the old days. And listener, if you're at a small school and you're half the psych faculty, you ain't got resources. Don't tell me you can't do science. See, that's what amazes me. People say, I don't have a grant. Yeah, I don't need a grant. You need to be creative. You need to find out, what do people do? You know, I didn't have any resources. And I did this most of my career. I've had an NIH national grant. That was in a whole nother area. But my research on procrastination, I ain't at a big university where people have the resources and the funding and have grants. I did it myself. I wasn't the student of anybody famous where I could piggyback on their name. No, I had to pull myself up. So I get frustrated when people say, well, I'm too busy teaching. I've got, you know, committee work. I can't do science. That's poo-poo, you know? That's a lie. Or no, that's a fraudulent excuse, as we would say.
Ooh, yes.
All right? Yes. So anyway, back to my paradigm. So does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So they have a number of columns, number of rows with different index cards in them with different information, and they can choose from which column or which row, and then you see how many from which column and from which row they're taking information from. Yeah.
So we could Okay. So we could look at how many inter and intra-dimensional shifts that they made. This was all based on Payne's paradigm procedure. So a listener, if it's still confusing, try to look at John Payne. There are other Paynes. There's a lot of Paynes in the neck, but Paynes in there is like. Okay, so what you would also do, besides these columns, you would have to label them. Let me give you concrete. So Payne looked at consumer issues, like having to buy a refrigerator. And I'm thinking, this has got nothing to do with college students. Why would college students? So instead, I created, my paradigm was, you have to choose a class next term. And these are different characteristics of the class. Time of day, the instructor's reputation, the amount of work. So every column had a different characteristic. You had index cards about that. Time of day, backwards, you did early morning, randomly mixed in there, you know, morning, afternoon, evening, quality of instructor, fine, easy, amount of work, little. So you wouldn't know. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The only way you would know is to flip the card.
Right. Yeah.
And see. Yep. Okay. So, and I can't remember all the other dimensions. Look at the articles first. People, 98, 97. You can find them. Anyway. So that was the experimental paradigm, which is another thing. A lot of people will say all this procrastination research is all on self-report correlational. No, no, no. A lot of my stuff was experimental. So I resent that comment too, the fact that they don't do experimental studies. No. Or people do experimental today and say, we're one of the first. No, you haven't read my work. Okay. And I don't mean to sound conceited that way, but unfortunately, listener, too many people in science today don't go back beyond 5, 7 years. That's old. Well, that doesn't mean it's bad. You know, maybe somebody pioneered something and nobody gave any attention to it, like in my case. So go back, read the original stuff, please. And you'll see there's far more experiments were done than you might think. So what did we find? We did a couple of experiments. DeVideo, Ferrari and DeVideo. We looked at the bottom line, the takeaway from a couple of publications on this was indecisives search less information than decisive people. And the indecisives will sort of just focus on one dimension. All right. And just search that information. So the analogy I would give to people when I've talked to them, imagine we're buying a car. You're the decisive. I'm the indecisive. All right. You as a decisive may read about, and I don't know all the German models out there, so I'll give you US models. So you might read about Toyotas and about Fords and about Chevrolets because you're the decisive. Me, I'm the indecisive. I'll only read about the Fords. See? And I'll search all about that. So they limit, so contrary to what people might think, indecisives limit the amount of information. They just gravitate towards this one thing because that's kind of interesting. So we found that in a couple of studies, you might think instead they search everything. No, they actually become much more narrow in what they're doing. So they both make a choice. So you may choose the Ford too, and I may choose the Ford as well, but I'll have done it by only knowing about Ford. You chose the Ford after reading about the others. What does this got to do with medical? Ah, it means you might say, this is the... I'm not a physician, so I don't know. But no, this is the medical treatment we're going to use, and this is all you're going to focus on because this is what we've always done. And I may choose that too, only after if I was the decisive, or only after I've looked at alternative approaches. See, so we're both treating the patient well, but one does it by eliminating other possibilities. If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
You might say, well, I don't have time. It's I have to be fast. I got to go with what we know works. Maybe, you know, or is that a fraudulent excuse?
Well, I have a question here on this. So in perfectionism, I believe that people collect too much information and they don't make a decision because they feel like they never reach, you know, all of the information that is available. So how do you know when is enough information enough and when is a decision better than no decision, you know? Because you can't always have every bit of information.
No, you can't. And some people keep searching. And before we book that flight, before I book that hotel, I want to read about every hotel and go on every review. And I got to read there's 1,294 reviews. Well, I got to read every one of those. That's right. When is that enough? Is 30 reviews sufficient? I can't. There's nothing magical I can pull out my sleeve and say, this is the answer. But exactly. It becomes a little obsessive to never make that decision. And it's not just perfectionism, but that's a great point. There comes a point where you have to say enough is enough and move on. And that's a good point. So because if I never decide, goes back to behavioral procrastination. If I never decide and someone else decides, then it's not my fault if things don't go well. When I give talks, public talks in this, I use this example, if I may. Where I live out here in the western burbs of Chicago, there's a movie theater with 31 movies. 31 movies. Now, imagine going with your friend who's indecisive to that movie theater. You stand there and you look and you see all the shows, right? And you say, what do you want to see? And what's their answer going to be? I don't know. What do you want to see? And you say, I don't know. What I decided last time, you decide. And again, they say, I don't know. There's so many good ones, whatever they might say. And you look at your watch and you say, you know, it's 7 o'clock and they're all starting in 10 minutes. We've really got to decide. Now, this is so what happens? Who decides? You do. Right. Now, that's a brilliant move on their part. Because at the end of the movie, if the movie was great, everybody leaves the theater happy. But what if the movie was a stinker? It was a real dud. The person will say, you just made me waste, you know, 12 euros. I don't know, whatever the movie costs in your area. You know, what a waste. So they never come across looking poorly. So when the indecisive lets the decisive partner make decisions, you decided that car. You said we had to go on this trip. I didn't want to buy that refrigerator. Boy, that table was not what I wanted, you know. But somebody had to make the decision. What I say to the indecisive is you have a right not to decide. You have every right. You don't have to make the decision. But if someone else does, and you were given the chance to make it, and someone else makes that decision, then you really forfeit your right to complain.
Yeah.
You know, you've given it up, and you have to live with it. And don't make that first, even if it was a bad decision. Well, you could have, but you didn't, and that was okay. You didn't have to. Just don't go complaining about it, that the other person made the decision or wrong decision. Does that make sense?
That does make sense.
But people don't look at that. They come back and they make the... So the point is, it's not a cognitive failure problem. It's motivational. We know they search information differently. One line of research I'd love to do, never did, because I don't really do this work anymore, but any listener want to do it. Eye tracking, you know about eye tracking research these days?
No, enlighten me. Enlighten me.
Okay, so I've never done this. We used to have an eye tracker at DePaul University, but that guy left with the equipment. You could track how people, where people are looking. There's a way of sense, so you can track their eyes, and it's supposed to reveal certain things. Some people use it even in clinical kinds of research, but you can look at it. So I'd love to see, as they search information, not my card flipping dimensions, but look at how, where are they looking? Where are they searching? Would be also very interesting to look at. I think there was one study that was done, and I don't remember the results, a good 10, 12 years, a long time ago, that looked at eye tracking and indecision. But that's one study, and one study does not make a trend. You know, like we like to say in science, you need three data points. One, you just do it, and if you get the result you're looking for, you do it a second time to convince yourself. But 2 points only give you a straight line. You need to do it a third, replicate a third time to get a trend.
In terms of your experiment, and you've shown that indecisives collect less information before they reach the decision. What was there any kind of reason for it found? Like cognitively, are they just a bit overwhelmed? They can't take in more variables, like more options, or?
Do I have a concrete answer in any of those? We don't know, because again, this was done in the 90s, and I haven't seen really people following up what Ferrari's studies did, but I don't know if it's cognitively overwhelmed or as human beings. We're cognitive misers. I just taught this to my undergrad. So it's like, as human beings, we want to make our cognitive. There are some people who are excited. They have a need for cognition, it's called, need to know. But most people are cognitive misers. We don't. In other words, we look for the easy answer. We don't want to put the cognitive effort. And I think that might be work. I don't know the answer, but that would be my hypothesis, that that indecisives are more misers than others, to use that expression, cognitive miser. It's someone who just doesn't want to put the cognitive effort. It's easy. This is why stereotyping exists, perhaps. You know, it's easier to label everybody the same, so I don't have to get to know them. It's less cognitive effort. So I'll go with whatever the current product is to buy. Less cognitive effort. I'll decide on whatever vacation we're going to take because there's less cognitive effort. So we're cognitive misers, we would say. We don't like to spend that cognitive effort. I think that could be going on, but that's an empirical question. Let's have listener out there do the studies to find out.
I'd love for someone to do it.
I would too.
Yeah.
Where does the indecision come from? Well, there's no gene. You're not born for this. We looked at the development of indecision in a couple of studies. Now, I did these back in the 90s, and then in the 2000s, I worked with Tim Tibbett. He was a grad student. This was kind of a cool story. That's what I'm saying, folks. Don't sell yourself short. You can't do research. He was a grad student from Texas A&M. Texas, a totally different school. And I met him at a conference. I was doing some presentation. Comes up to me, goes, this is really great. I'd love to, learn more. And I said, that's great. I said, you do the studies and I'll mentor you along. So we have a number of Ferrari and Tibbett studies, or Tibbett and Ferrari. And he did a couple of those studies, a few of those studies. Unfortunately, in my view, he didn't go into academics. He went into business. That's why it's unfortunate, because this guy was really talented. But I was so impressed that here he was from a totally different school, had the confidence to come forward to a stranger and say, let's collaborate. I've had that a few times in my life, from undergrads to graduates, including a high school student who did this. But all right, back to the development. Before I partnered with Tim Tibbett, I did some other studies with some of my DePaul students. And what we found was that it's fathers, not mothers, who make children become indecisive and procrastinators, behavioral procrastinators. Why? Well, they usually have a very stern, demanding parent. We call that the authoritative, I believe. The person who says, you do what I say, and the kid can't make a decision. And the kid doesn't act on that. I know I talked about this on the procrastination, but it's the same thing with indecision, we found. The scores on the man scale of indecision was high. You learn it, like everything in your home. If people are interested in that man scale, it's only published in my 1995 book, Procrastination and Task Avoidance, Theory, Research, and Avoidance, and Treatments, it's by Ferrari, Johnson, and McCowan. It's expensive because it's out of print. It's 1995. It was by Plenum, then Plenum sold out to Springer. But, you know, people sometimes write to me and say, can I have the scale? And I have to say, I can't give it to you. It's copyrighted. You're going to have to buy the book. And you get it that way. But it's a 5-item scale on indecision. I really like it because it's short. It's got good reliability, meaning 0.7 point at least. For short scale, it's internally consistent. It's got good retest reliability as well. And I would always recommend that. There may be others. There are other indecision scales, but they're 15, 20 questions, and maybe they're free. But why take your participants longer time if you're going to have something shorter?
If I can summarize, that's people who are indecisive tend to have fathers who are cold and demanding. And for whatever reason, this has led them to be procrastinator.
The only way I can react, the only way I can survive with such a controlling, demanding parent is not to make a decision, you know, because daddy will yell at me.
Decision.
He may punish me. Whatever the reason, the consequences, I don't want to get in trouble. We also found with the behavioral procrastinators, the mother was indecisive. So again, dad's demanding. I go running to mommy. What do I do? And what does she say? I don't know, honey. He's your father. You got to, you know, that kind of stuff. Don't want to get in between. So it's interesting. The point is there's so much more that can be done. You don't have to do just correlation. Listener, you don't have to do correlational studies. Do some good experimental studies. You can do it by looking at reaction time to look at people who are indecisive, and there's nothing wrong with that. Or you could do it by self-report measures. And as a social personality psychologist, my work is always much more on the self-report using a scale and deciding people that way. But yeah, it's a great area of research. I appreciate you including me today in all of this. And I hope the listener finds some comfort. Remember, it's learned. So like everything, if you've learned something, you can unlearn it. So there's change as possible. You can learn to make decisions. And if you make a decision and it's wrong, unless it's a life and death decision, it's okay. I guess if I'm a brain surgeon or a surgeon, I don't want to make the wrong decision. So that's true. But if I'm dealing with a patient, search more information, find out what are the different alternatives, be open to that, and be more decisive. Make the risk. If we don't take risks in life, we don't succeed in life.
Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. I really love how you are very personal. You credit your co-workers, your co-authors. I think that's really lovely. I also find...
Nobody does research alone. No one does research alone. They shouldn't take the credit alone.
You're very, just nice the way... You're very, personal. It's really nice. And... it's also very inspiring. I mean, you said you started your research, how you started it. You know, you didn't wait for grants. You were just inspired. You wanted to research it. And that is very inspiring. And I hope someone listening to this, even if, the field of procrastination is not their field, they'll at least be inspired to do research. And I am going to recommend your book, Still Procrastinating, The No Regrets Guide to Getting It Done. That's by Deacon Joseph Ferrari. And if you're more interested in this topic, definitely give that a read and listen to our first podcast episode. He also has his older book, which is Procrastination and Task Avoidance, Theory, Research and Treatment. That is by Ferrari, Johnson and McCown, which is no longer in print, so is somewhat more expensive. But if you're wanting more information on that topic, you can also see it in that book. Once again, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for sharing your knowledge, your expertise. It's been lovely.
Thank you. Thank you for including me. Thank you for trying to improve the quality of life for others. That's so important that people forget. So thank you.
Vielen Dank, dass du heute wieder zugehört hast und unser Gast gewesen bist. Wir hoffen sehr, dass dir dieser Beitrag gefallen hat und du etwas für deinen klinischen Alltag mitnehmen konntest. Wenn dem so sein sollte, dann freuen wir uns sehr über eine positive Bewertung bei Apple Podcasts. Falls du Lust hast mitzumachen und es einen Themenbereich gibt, in dem du dich besonders gut auskennst, dann melde dich doch gerne unter kontakt@klinisch-relevant.de. Gleiches gilt, wenn du Themenvorschläge oder konstruktive Kritik für uns hast. An dieser Stelle auch der Hinweis auf unseren Newsletter, den du unter www.klinisch-relevant.de abonnieren kannst und der dich immer auf dem Laufenden hält. Wenn du dich für unseren Newsletter einträgst, bekommst du einen 5-Euro-Gutschein, mit dem du in unserer Fortbildungsakademie einkaufen kannst. Wir wünschen dir jetzt bis zum nächsten Mal eine gute Zeit und freuen uns, wenn du bald wieder einschaltest. Pass auf dich auf, bleib gesund. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Ciao.